something very abstract, and so they want to get films from like all over.
From New Zealand to Australia to the Aleutian Chain of Alaska, Indigenous filmmakers share stories of their cultures and ways of life. Tuido says she notices a lot of differences from one continent to the next.
Just to see how other people live or other viewpoints of living is, I think, really special. I've learned a lot just about different cultures from around the world, and so I think that's really cool, and different ways of storytelling. How someone in New Zealand tells a story a lot different than someone, say, from Finland. And just it's cool to see the diversity.
Tuido says Native Shorts is a great platform to showcase short films, when in the past it was only shown at film festivals. I'm Jill Freitas.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 30th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth. Up next, the Global Citizen International Digest and an interview with the creators of Fake Radio's performance of Miracle on 34th Street.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. First, an update on the Biden-Xi summit. Now that a few weeks have passed since the San Francisco summit, we can take a hard look at what was and was not accomplished. On the three biggest agreements, the fentanyl trade, climate change, and military talks, the jury is out. First, what was agreed? China agreed to block companies that produce the precursors to fentanyl production from exporting to Mexico. Both countries agreed to triple renewable energy production globally by 2030, so as to accelerate the substitution for coal, oil, and gas generation. Third, they agreed to resume military-to-military talks. Will these agreements be fulfilled? On fentanyl, the Chinese told U.S. officials they had already taken action against 25 chemical plants involved in fentanyl production and will continue to crack down on others. Biden has already expressed doubts that they will or can do this. The challenge goes beyond China. Its chemical industries are numerous, fentanyl may be replaced by another synthetic drug, and the supply chain might move to another country. On climate change, the two envoys, John Kerry and Xie Zhenhua, met in California before the summit and carved out a statement of common purpose on climate change. That agreement includes reaching a deal on methane and other non-CO2 greenhouse gas emissions. But there are strong reasons to doubt that China will stop building coal-fired plants. That's the main problem. Stop or significantly reduce reliance on coal and stop importing coal from abroad. In 2022, permits to start construction on new coal-firing plants were the highest in 7 years. New coal capacity is twice what it was when Xi Jinping pledged in April 2021 to, quote, strictly control coal-fired power generation projects in China. On military talks, China must first name a defense minister. The last one, General Li Shanfu, was abruptly dismissed before the talks with U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin can resume. When they do, the two ministers will need to deal with the close encounters between U.S. and Chinese aircraft and ships in the South China Sea, with China's harassing flights near Taiwan, and with Philippines-China territorial waters disputes, all very difficult on which to find agreement. Previous Biden-Xi summits in 2021 and 2022 resulted in similar expressions of common interest that held out hope for a reset in U.S.-China relations. But the same issues that have long bedeviled relations reemerged, such as Taiwan, trade, human rights, U.S. security partnerships in Asia-Pacific, as well as unexpected disruptions, such as the spy balloon incident. We have to be prepared for the pattern to be repeated, particularly with a presidential election coming up in Taiwan amidst ongoing and unsubstantiated talk in the U.S. about an eventual Chinese attack on Taiwan. Those are ingredients for more tension, not more engagement. There is, however, and on the other hand, high-level Chinese commentary on Sino-U.S. relations lately in the official press has been rather even-handed and positive, emphasizing dialogue and avoiding blame. Let's hope that perspective becomes the dominant one. The far right wins in Argentina and Netherlands. The significance of Javier Milei's overwhelming victory in Argentina's presidential election may be judged by the company he keeps. Donald Trump and Jair Bolsonaro were quick to hail his win as a great triumph. The Guardian describes Milei this way, quote, "Born in Buenos Aires in 1970, he played in a Rolling Stones cover band and found fame as a foul-mouthed economic pundit on Argentine television before being elected to Congress in 2021 for his Libertarian Party. Milei's mercurial personality, expletive-ridden on-screen outbursts, and Britpop-style hairdo have cemented his reputation as El Loco, the madman." Unquote. Milei's win might be ascribed to the success of radical right politics, but it more likely is due to the Argentine economy's sad state, 150% inflation and widespread poverty. Those conditions called for change, and the fact that Milei's opponent was an economy minister made him an easy target. But Milei's honeymoon may be short. His advocacy of austerity measures to revive the economy may only worsen it. People may rebel once they experience what austerity means for their livelihoods. One of Milei's first acts may be to cut ties with China and Brazil, arguing that as communist leftist-ruled countries, they cannot be trusted. China's foreign ministry spokeswoman said doing so would be a, quote, serious mistake. Meantime, China scored a diplomatic triumph nearby as Uruguay agreed to establish a, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership with China. Xi Jinping said this upgrading of relations is a, quote, model for solidarity and cooperation between countries of different sizes, systems, and cultures. In the Netherlands, the party of Geert Wilders, a voice for getting rid of immigrants among other far-right causes, won a major victory in national elections November 22nd. His Party for Freedom won 37 seats in the 150-seat parliament. Wilders is a provocateur of long standing, anti-Islam, anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ, anti-European Union. On winning, Wilders said he wanted to return the Netherlands to the Dutch. No doubt he too will be hearing from Trump. Wilders might not be able to withdraw Holland from the EU or terminate immigration because of opposition in parliament. But as prime minister, he is certainly positioned to carry out his threat to overturn some elements of liberal politics. He will have to form a coalition with other right-leaning parties. The main opposition party, which won 24 seats, has refused to join. The next climate change conference doesn't look promising. The United Nations has painted a dire picture, one of several in recent years, in which countries aren't doing nearly enough to keep global warming within relatively safe levels. Today's report shows that governments combined are taking baby steps to avert the climate crisis, said Simone Steele, the executive director of the UN Climate Change Agency. And it shows why governments must make bold strides forward, he said. As of now, even if countries fulfill their current climate pledges, the average global temperature is projected to increase by up to 2.8 degrees above pre-industrial levels, which probably means catastrophic consequences for many countries' security, food production, and coastal structures. A companion study by climate scientists in Saudi Arabia paints a picture of an existential crisis if global warming persists. In this critical juncture, their report says, Saudi Arabia faces a momentous choice to adapt and innovate in the face of climate adversity or suffer the severe and potentially irrevocable consequences of inaction. Crisis indeed, considering how much carbon Saudi Arabia's oil fields, the backbone of its economy, put into the atmosphere. Climate change is already a major concern throughout the Middle East. Severe drought afflicts Syria, Iran, and Iraq, according to another study. In that fertile crescent, wheat harvests have declined dramatically, water is growing scarce, and populations are on the move to avoid hunger. The likelihood of progress at the next UN-sponsored climate talks, the Conference of the Parties, COP28, grows dimmer by the week. The setting will be the United Arab Emirates, a petro-state, and the meetings will be chaired for the first time by an oil company executive. Fossil fuel lobbyists will dominate the participants list. An environmental activist group has found that over the years of international climate conferences, over 7,000 of those lobbyists have attended. As Senator Sheldon Whitehouse says, quote, I do think that both the leadership of this COP and the attendance of so many fossil fuel interests and front groups will diminish the COP's success, unquote. That's a modest way of saying that money talks. Speaking of money, the man who controls a great deal of it, Ajay Banga, an Indian former corporate executive and now the first person from the Global South to be president of the World Bank, says he's committed to helping the world's poor deal with climate change. He faces doubts from every quarter. In other news, oil stocks are up. Alternative energy stocks are down. With all the news about how wind and solar power are displacing fossil fuels as energy sources in the wake of rapid climate change, one would think the stock market would reflect that shift. But no, clean energy stocks, in fact, are taking a beating. As one reporter writes, quote, the stock market doesn't seem to have gotten the memo. Instead, the shares of a broad range of clean energy companies have been crushed lately in a rout that encompasses just about every alternative energy sector, including solar, wind, and geothermal power, unquote. One reason is that the big oil companies are becoming bigger, drilling more, crude oil production hit a record high in November, and convincing the financial world that the future of energy still belongs to them. The world's richest people invest in fossil fuels, and an Oxfam study finds that the 1% account for as much carbon emissions as the poorest two-thirds of the global population. It's also unfortunately true that the huge costs of major green energy projects are keeping their stocks down. In recent months, for instance, large-scale wind energy projects in our Northeast, valued in the billions of dollars, have either had to be abandoned or halted due to rising costs. Foreign investment in China is declining. For the first time in 25 years, foreign direct investment in China is declining. So fast, in fact, that more foreign funds left China last year than were put into China. Three reasons seem to stand out. The downslide in China's economy, the Biden administration's order that limits U.S. investment in China's semiconductor and AI sectors, and China's crackdown on foreign firms. Many foreign firms are now taking their profits home rather than reinvesting in their Chinese branches. Altogether, some $160 billion has left China over the last year and a half. China's economic woes may be even worse than many are saying. An analysis by the Financial Times of London suggests that China's share of the global economy has fallen for the first time ever, partly because of the reduced foreign investment in China, as well as poor employment prospects, business debt, and lower productivity. China is still growing by about 5% a year based on GDP, but the Financial Times report argues that that figure obscures the decline in China's once top-tier place as a driver of global growth. No wonder Xi Jinping, while in San Francisco, sought to woo U.S. corporate leaders at a glitzy dinner with the message that China remains open for foreign investors. No wonder, too, that Chinese themselves are sending money abroad. In a word, confidence in China's future is a shared concern among foreigners and Chinese alike. Myanmar's junta is in trouble. Myanmar's military dictatorship, which seized power in 2021, suddenly is vulnerable to attack from the hodgepodge resistance forces loosely aligned under a national unity government. These forces are of two kinds: ethnic minority armies that have a long history of opposition to the military government, and pro-democracy groups backed by the national unity government. What makes the resistance so threatening to the military now is that the various armies are coordinating and becoming increasingly successful, mainly in the areas that border China. The opposition has captured towns, seized arsenals, and obtained the surrender of some government units. Thousands of people have fled the fighting, mainly into India. But the junta has superior forces on the ground and in the air. Greater destruction is a real possibility. China and Japan to meet on the Fukushima ban. Prime Minister Kishida Fumio said that China had agreed to expert-level talks aimed at addressing its ban on Japanese seafood following the release of the Fukushima nuclear power plant's wastewater. China banned all Japanese seafood imports in August after Japan began to release the treated wastewater from the nuclear plant damaged in the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami that hit the Tohoku region. Kishida said he discussed the wastewater row with Chinese President Xi Jinping when they met on the sidelines of an Asia-Pacific summit in San Francisco. Kishida said he and Xi agreed to, quote, seek to find a resolution through consultation and dialogue based upon a constructive attitude. In the days ahead, discussions will take place based upon science at the expert level, Kishida said at a news conference. Finally, China takes a position on the Israel-Hamas war. At a meeting in Beijing of foreign ministers from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and a few other countries, Foreign Minister Wang Yi offered a 5-point proposal for resolving the crisis. As is often the case with China's diplomacy in a faraway crisis, this proposal assumes no responsibility for doing anything to ease it and pretends that China has been consistent in its support of the Palestinian cause. The main motivation is to present China as a major power actor in a drama in which it has been a bit player. China's 5 points are immediate ceasefire, end to forced displacement of Palestinians, a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, an active role by the UN Security Council, an international conference that aims to bring about the two-state solution. Rest assured that the proposal, though quite reasonable, will have little influence over the course of events. U.S.-Israel relations still count the most. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The holiday season is in full swing. Christmas is right around the corner, and that means the annual reappearance of film classics such as It's a Wonderful Life, A Christmas Story, Elf, Bad Santa, and one of my very favorites, Miracle on 34th Street. Those of you who are not old-time radio fans might not know that the original 1947 film starring Maureen O'Hara, John Payne, Edmund Gwenn, and a very young Natalie Wood was adapted for the Lux Radio Theater and performed live on air on December 22nd of that year. 76 years later, here we are. It's finally coming to Portland, thanks to the folks at Fake Radio, the nation's premier old-time radio comedy troupe. Fake Radio will recreate live on stage the original 1947 broadcast, including the commercials, just as it was done then, with actors on stage holding their scripts and standing before microphones. But unlike the original production, the Fake Radio actors occasionally go off script, especially for the commercials, much to the delight of the audience. The only Portland performance of Fake Radio's Miracle on 34th Street takes place this Sunday, December 3rd, at EcoTrust Irving Street Studio in Portland. We're fortunate to have Fake Radio's artistic director David Koff and two of the cast members here with us to preview the show: actor, writer, producer Jonathan Stark, a co-creator of the sitcom According to Jim, and actress Lynn Stewart, who among many other credits played Miss Yvonne on Pee-wee's Playhouse. Well, Jonathan, fake radio has a long history from its early beginnings in L.A., now here in Portland as well, under the direction of David Koff. He's the artistic director of fake radio. It's a little different than the usual live theater troupe. So can you tell us what listeners can expect at a fake radio show?
Well, what you expect, you're going to expect to laugh, first of all,
because yes.
What we do is the Lux Radio program was the most popular show on the radio in the 40s and even into the 50s. And what they would do was to hawk their shows when something came out, like in this case, Miracle on 34th Street, which actually came out in the summer of 1948. They cut it down to an hour and they bring in the stars. They got Jimmy Stewart in Wonderful Life. They got all that Donna Reed, and they got all the stars in this. They got Edmund Gwynn and
John Payne, Maureen O'Hara.
John Payne, Maureen O'Hara.
Yeah.
These people, you know, these people were not easy to get, but they knew this was a way to hawk their show and get, because they were on the most popular show on radio at the time. So what we do is we basically take that script, that hour script, and we read it. Now, we try and stick to the script for the most part, but as we go along, we start to diverge a little bit. We have a little fun with the lines, and by the end, it's just pandemonium. The interesting thing is, too, they have Lux Radio or Lux Flakes commercials.
Yes.
Part of it, they have announcers come in. They have starlets who you've probably never heard of and will never hear of. And everything has to do with Lux Flakes. And, oh, that complexion of yours, or Lux Toilet Soap. They call it toilet soap. Why? I mean, who wants to buy soap that with the name toilet in it? I don't know. They have Lux Toilet Soap. And, you know, it's just so funny. And sometimes within that, it gets a little misogynistic, not from our point of view, but from what's written on the script, because that was 1948. And, you know, it's fun. The audience is encouraged to groan at it and laugh at it. And we laugh right along with them. We have everybody in back of the microphones to get up and sit down and everything during the thing. And we sit back there and laugh just as much as the audience does.
Now, you've performed, Jonathan, in several fake radio productions. In fact, we first met, you were in Portland 5 years ago for one very memorable show, an 80th anniversary production of War of the Worlds, the Orson Welles version from the radio. As an actor, what do you enjoy about fake radio that maybe you don't get performing in stage theater or on TV?
Well, you know, with War of the Worlds, that's the only thing we don't improvise. We play that, we play the drama of that. We don't improvise it. And I love doing that because I worked with a couple actors there, Sam Mowry, who is just a terrific actor.
Just like Orson Welles.
Yeah, he does. And he was great. We did a couple of scenes together, and I just loved doing that scene with Sam.
Phil Proctor, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Phil, yeah. Phil's wonderful. And then the other one, when we do the comedy, I think it's like the idea that we start out doing a dramatic show or something that everybody knows. That's why we do Miracle on 34th Street or It's a Wonderful Life, because everybody knows those. So they know when we start to go off script a little bit. So, you know, if you're doing a drama on stage or something like that, you can't very well just start improvising your lines. So all the people that are up there, and the Portland group is fantastic. They're just wonderful and great people. And Lynn knows that. She's been up there. And it just to be able to improvise within the drama is what makes it so much fun.
In fact, Lynn, you were here in 2019 for the Maltese Falcon fake radio production.
Oh, that was really, really fun. And the group's fantastic. I mean, they're all friends and they're very welcoming. You know, they were just lovely to me. It was like, you know, gobble gobble, one of us. I mean, they were just so sweet.
Oh, you'll be joining the cast for the Portland performance of Miracle on 34th Street. There was one on the 18th in Los Angeles. What role are you playing in the Sunday show?
I'm going to play Doris. I'm going to play the woman who does not believe in Santa Claus and has the daughter, and who is in the movie, my daughter was Natalie Wood. And Maureen O'Hara played the part that I'm going to be playing now.
Ah, you're filling in for Maureen O'Hara. That's
I am. I'm filling in for Maureen O'Hara.
She's often mistaken for Maureen O'Hara.
I know. The spitting image. Now, Lynn, Do you have memories of Christmas past watching the original 1947 film on TV, or maybe even catching it on the big screen?
Yes, I do. I love the scene where Santa does sign language, and he speaks other languages to the kids that come up to him and sit on his lap. And Natalie Wood is just watching this, and she's so torn because her mother told her, her mother had a bad breakup with her dad, and she always tells her the truth because she doesn't want her to get hurt, and she said there is no Santa Claus. And then Natalie Wood starts to see this Kris Kringle, and he knows different languages, he knows how to do sign language, and he's exactly like her vision of Santa Claus, what Santa Claus is. She's torn. She doesn't know whether to believe her mother or believe her eyes and see how Santa reacts to the kids.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, Jonathan, how about you? What are your memories of the movie? I know it's both heartwarming and funny, kind of a perfect blend for the holidays.
Well, you know, I like any movie with Santa Claus in it. I mean, I just do. Even Bad Santa was fun for me.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, but this one is really particularly great because Edmund Gwynn is just the best. I mean, I can't think offhand of a better Santa Claus in any film than Edmund Gwynn. He was Santa Claus to me. You know, and I remember watching
when
I was younger, and I really thought he was Santa Claus, and maybe he is.
I wouldn't doubt it. Well, it was proven in a court of law in the movie, so it's good enough for me. Now, Lynn, I know David Koff, the artistic director, likes to have a certain degree of spontaneity and surprise in each fake radio performance, and you'll have the script with you on stage as the other actors will. How do you prepare? Are there any read-throughs or rehearsals in advance?
We have like one read-through, but I'm going to be doing a commercial, I don't know which one, but with John. And John and I have worked together for so many years. And so if there's going to be any play or fun, that it'll be with John Stark, because I have a long history with him. We were in the Groundlings together. We're in an improv workshop. He's the wrangler. He's the catalyst. He's the one that got it all together. He's a unbelievably genius. I just could go on and on. improviser.
Well, it's a lot of fun to work with him,
whatever I'm doing.
Let me throw one back at you. When I first started in the Groundlings, I actually was in, I don't know, one of the classes there. I got a job working as the stage manager, one of the stage managers on the original Pee-wee show. Now, I didn't know Lynn or Paul or Phil or John Paragon, but I would go, I was lucky enough to be there for every performance when they did it at the Groundlings. And I would just stand there and I thought, so this is what real talent is. You know, I'd only been in town a couple of years, and watching John and Phil and Paul and Lynn, it was just magic. And right away, I remember looking at Lynn and say, I want to be friends with this person. I just love her so much. And she has no idea who I am, but I will, if she doesn't want to be my friend, I will love her from afar.
You know, he was a handsome young buck of a stage manager.
Oh, you were after every guy in that whole place.
No, ad-libbing, improvising, going off script is part of a fake radio production, and you're both masters of improv and sketch comedy, going back to the Groundlings. And Lynn, you as Miss Yvonne on Pee-wee's Playhouse, how do you strike that balance between ad-libbing and staying true to the script?
Well, if you can throw in a line in here and there, but when it's a classic, I like sticking pretty close to the script because I want the audience to recognize it, you know, and follow along. If you go too far off, you know, they'll laugh, but they could possibly get a little lost because it's like, what are they doing? But where I think the fun is in the commercial, because you can really cut loose in the commercials. that's where I think a lot of the humor is.
The thing I love about fake radio is the thing David, why he's such a good director, is that he says, look, you can have fun as we go along. It can get more and more crazy, but you can't go off script, because we're reading a script here. And we're playing something that people know. We can't, you know, the improv has to be really, it's very actually more difficult than it seems when you're up there. If you're in the audience watching, it seems like we're just throwing around, but you're always constantly going, all right, I don't want to go here. I don't want to go there. I don't want to take it too far, because we have to stick to the script and get through the script.
All of the sort of original moving parts of Robin's, you know, germ of an idea are still there, right? So people show up, we're still reading a script, so folks don't need to memorize it. But as John was suggesting, they do still need to prepare, because even if you plan to improvise in advance based on, you know, a line in a script, the flow of the show may indicate at that particular moment of time, yeah, no, I'm not going to do this. So there is some sort of in-the-moment calculation that occurs. But yeah, that's kind of where we're at.
Well, Lynn, we've mentioned a few of the actors. David has, John has. I mentioned Phil Proctor, the Firesign Theater. There's three kids in the hall: Kevin McDonald, Dave Foley, Mark McKinney, Lorraine Newman from SNL, Phil Lamar, Deborah Wilson from Mad TV, Mindy Sterling, Ray Romano, Fred Willard, Jeff Garland, George Wendt, Marsha Wallace. So it's kind of like being part of this improv hall of fame.
Yeah, it's so exciting. I got to work with Fred Willard, and I, you know, he was just fantastic. And he was a friend, and you go and you see old friends, and so many of us have histories together, and it's just fun to get together and play.
We've been talking with David Koff, artistic director of Fake Radio, actor, writer, producer Jonathan Stark, co-creator of According to Jim, and actress Lynn Stewart, who you might know as Miss Yvonne on Pee-wee's Playhouse. They'll be performing in Fake Radio